Chapter 31.
You've promised what to that old Methuselah?
You heard.
You were joking, I hope.
I can't lie to an old man who's at death's door, no matter how fresh he turns out to be.
And that does you credit, Daniel. But how do you think you're going to slip a whore into this holy house?
By paying her three times as much, I suppose. I leave all the specifics to you. Fermin shrugged resignedly.
Oh, well, a deal's a deal.
We'll think of something, but remember, next time a negotiation of this nature turns up, let me do the talking.
Agreed.
Just as the crafty old devil had instructed, we found Jacinto Coronado in a loft that could only be reached by a staircase on the third floor. According to the old man, the attic was the refuge for the few patients whom fate had not yet had the decency to deprive of understanding. Apparently this hidden wing had in its day housed the rooms of Baltasar Delufeo, a.k.a. Laszlo de Vichigny, from which he governed the Tenebrarium's activities and cultivated the loving arts newly arrived from the east, amid clouds of perfume and scented oils. And there was no lack of scent now, though of a very different nature. A woman who could only be Jacinto Coronado sagged in a wicker chair, wrapped in a blanket.
"Signora Coronado?"
I asked, raising my voice, in case the poor thing was deaf, half-witted, or both. The elderly woman examined us carefully with some reserve. Her eyes looked bleary, and only a few wisps of whitish hair covered her head. I noticed that she gave me a puzzled look, as if she'd seen me before but couldn't remember where. I was afraid Fermin was going to rush into introducing me as the son of Carax or some similar lie, but all he did was kneel down next to the old lady and take her trembling, wrinkled hand.
"Jacinta, I'm Fermin, and this handsome young lad is my friend, Daniel. Father Fernando Ramos sent us. He wasn't able to come today because he had 12 masses to say. You know what the calendar of saints' days is like. But he sends you his best regards. How are you feeling?"
The old woman smiled sweetly at Fermin. My friend stroked her face and her forehead. She appreciated the touch of another skin, like a purring cat. I felt a lump in my throat.
"A stupid question, wasn't it?" Fermin went on. "What you'd like is to be out there, dancing a foxtrot. You look like a dancer. Everyone must tell you that."
I had never seen him treat anyone with such delicacy, not even Bernarda. His words were pure flattery, but the tone and expression on his face were sincere.
"What pretty things you say,"
she murmured in a voice that was broken from not having had anyone to speak to or anything to say.
"Not half as pretty as you, Jacinta. Do you think we could ask you some questions? Like on a radio contest, you know?"
The old woman just blinked in response.
"I'd say that's a yes. Do you remember Penelope, Jacinta? Penelope Aldaya. It's her we'd like to ask you about."
Jacinta's eyes suddenly lit up and she nodded.
"My girl,"
she murmured. And it looked like she was going to burst into tears.
"The very one. You do remember, don't you? We're friends of Julian Carax, the one who told scary stories. You remember that too, don't you?"
The old woman's eyes shone, as if those words and the touch on her skin were bringing her back to life by the minute.
"Father Fernando from St. Gabriel's told us you adored Penelope. He loves you very much too and thinks of you every day, you know. If he doesn't come more often, it's just because the new bishop, a social climber, loads him with such a quota of masses that his voice gives out."
"Are you sure you eat enough?"
the old lady suddenly asked, with a worried expression.
"I eat like a horse, Jacinta. The trouble is, I have a very manly metabolism and I burn it all up. But believe me, under these clothes, it's all pure muscle. Feel, feel. Like Charles Atlas, only hairier."
Jacinta nodded and looked reassured. She couldn't take her eyes off Fermin. She had forgotten about me completely. What can you tell us about Penelope and Julian?
Between them all, they took her from me, she said. My girl.
I took a step forward and was about to say something, but Fermin threw me a look that told me to remain silent. Who took Penelope from you, Jacinta? Do you remember?
The master, she said, raising her eyes fearfully, as if she thought someone might hear us.
Fermin seemed to be gauging the emphasis of the old woman's gesture and followed her eyes to the ceiling, weighing up the possibilities.
Are you referring to God Almighty, Emperor of the Heavens, or did you mean the master, Miss Penelope's father, Don Ricardo?
How's Fernando? Asked the old woman.
The priest? Splendid. One day he'll be made Pope and will set you up in the Sistine Chapel. He sends you all the best.
He's the only one who comes to see me, you know. He comes because he knows I don't have anyone else.
Fermin gave me a sideways look, as if he were thinking what I was thinking. Jacinta Coronado was much saner than her appearance suggested. Her body was fading away, but her mind and her soul were still blazing with anguish in that wretched place. I wondered how many more people like her, or like the lusty little old man who had shown us how to find her, were trapped in there.
He comes because he's very fond of you, Jacinta, because he remembers how well you looked after him and how you fed him when he was a child. He's told us all about that. Do you remember, Jacinta? Do you remember those days when you went to collect Jorge from school? Do you remember Fernando and Julian?
Julian.
She whispered the name slowly, but a smile betrayed her.
Do you remember Julian Carax, Jacinta?
I remember the day Penelope told me she was going to marry him.
Fermin and I looked at one another in astonishment.
Marry? When was that, Jacinta?
The first day she saw him. She was 13 and didn't know who he was or what he was called.
Then how did she know she was going to marry him?
Because she'd seen him in her dreams.
As a child, Maria Jacinta Coronado was convinced that the world ended on the outskirts of Toledo, and that beyond the town limits there was nothing but darkness and oceans of fire. Jacinta had got that idea from a dream she had during a fever that had almost killed her when she was 4 years old. This dream was the first of many, and they began with that mysterious fever, which some blamed on the sting of a huge red scorpion that appeared in the house one day and was never seen again, and others on the evil designs of a mad nun who crept into houses at night to poison children and who years later was to be garrotted reciting the Lord's Prayer backwards with her eyes popping out of their sockets while a red cloud spread over the town, discharging a storm of dead cockroaches. In her dreams, Jacinta perceived the past and the future and at times saw revealed to her the secrets and mysteries of the old streets of Toledo. One of the characters she would see repeatedly in her dreams was someone called Zacarias, an angel who was always dressed in black and who was accompanied by a dark cat with yellow eyes whose breath smelled of sulfur. Zacarias knew everything. He had predicted the day and the hour of her uncle Benancio's death, a hawker of ointments and holy water. He had revealed the place where her mother, a sanctimonious churchgoer, hid a bundle of letters from an ardent medical student with few financial resources but a solid knowledge of anatomy, and in whose bedroom in the alleyway of Santa Maria she had discovered the doors of paradise at an early age. Zacarias had announced to Jacinta that there was something evil fixed in her stomach, a dead spirit that wished her ill, and that she would know the love of only one man, an empty, selfish love that would break her soul in two.
He had augured that in her lifetime she would behold the death of everything she loved, and that before she reached heaven, she would visit hell. On the day of her first period, Zacharias and his sulfuric cat disappeared from her dreams, but years later Jacinta would remember the visits of the black angel with tears in her eyes, because all his prophecies had come true. So when the doctors diagnosed that she would never be able to have children, Jacinta wasn't surprised. Nor was she surprised, although she almost died of grief, when her husband of 3 years announced that he was going to leave her because she was like a wasteland that produced no fruit, because she wasn't a woman. In the absence of Zacharias, whom she took to be an emissary of heaven, for whether or not he was dressed in black, he was still a radiant angel and the best-looking man she had ever seen, Jacinta spoke to God on her own, hiding in corners, without seeing him or expecting him to bother with a reply, because there was a lot of pain in the world and her troubles were, in the end, only small matters. All her monologues with God dealt with the same theme. She wanted only one thing in life, to be a mother, to be a woman. One day, while she was praying in the cathedral, a man whom she recognized as Zacharias came up to her. He dressed as he always did, and held his malicious cat on his lap. He did not look a single day older, and still sported magnificent nails, like the nails of a duchess, long and pointed. The angel admitted that he was there because God didn't plan to answer her prayers. But he told her not to worry, because one way or another, he would send her a child. He leaned over her, murmured the word, "Tibi dabo," and kissed her very tenderly on the lips. At the touch of those fine, honeyed lips, Jacinta had a vision. She would have a daughter without further knowledge of man, which, judging from the 3 years in the bedroom with her husband, who insisted on doing his thing while covering her head with a pillow and mumbling, "Don't look, you slut," was a relief. This girl would come to her in a very faraway city, trapped between a crescent of mountains and a sea of light, a city filled with buildings that could exist only in dreams. Later, Jacinta was unable to tell her whether Zacharias's visit had been another of her dreams, or whether the angel really had come to her in Toledo Cathedral with his cat and his scarlet manicured nails. What she didn't doubt for a moment was the truth of those predictions. That very afternoon, she consulted the parish deacon, who was a well-read man and had seen the world. It was said that he had gone as far as Andorra and that he spoke a little Basque. The deacon claimed he did not know of an angel Zacharias among the winged legions of the heavens, but listened attentively to Jacinta's vision. After much consideration, and going by the description of some sort of cathedral that, in the words of the clairvoyant, sounded like a large hair comb made of melting chocolate, the wise man said, "Jacinta, what you've seen is Barcelona, the great enchantress, and the expiatory temple of the Sagrada Familia." 2 weeks later, armed with a bundle of clothes, a missal, and her first smile in 5 years, Jacinta was on her way to Barcelona, convinced that everything the angel had described to her would come true. Months of great hardship were to pass before Jacinta would find a permanent job in one of the stores of Aldaya and Sons, near the pavilions of the old 1888 Universal Exhibition in Ciutadella Park. The Barcelona of her dreams had changed into a sinister, hostile city, full of closed mansions, full of factories that poured forth their foggy breath, poisoning the air with coal and sulphur. Jacinta knew from the start that this city was a woman, cruel and vain. She learned to fear her and never look her in the eye. She lived alone in a pension in the Ribera quarter, where her pay barely afforded her a miserable room with no windows, whose only source of light came from the candles she stole from the cathedral. She kept these alight all night to scare away the rats that had already gnawed at the ears and fingers of a 6-month-old baby, the child of Ramonetta, a prostitute who rented the room next door, and the only friend Jacinta had managed to make in Barcelona in 11 months. That winter it rained almost every day, and the rain was blackened by soot. Soon Jacinta began to fear that Zacarias had deceived her, that she had come to that terrible city to die of cold, misery and oblivion. But Jacinta was prepared to survive. She went to the store every day before dawn, and did not come out again until well after nightfall. There Don Ricardo Aldaya happened to notice her, looking after the daughter of one of the foremen, who had fallen ill with consumption. When he saw the dedication and the tenderness that the young girl exuded, he decided to take her home with him to look after his wife, who was pregnant, with what would be his firstborn. Jacinta's prayers had been answered. That night, Jacinta saw Zacarias again in her dreams. The angel was no longer dressed in black. He was naked, and his skin was covered in scales. He didn't have his cat with him anymore, but a white snake coiled round his torso. His hair had grown down to his waist, and his smile, the honeyed smile she had kissed in Toledo Cathedral, was now lined with triangular, serrated teeth, like those she'd seen in some of the deep-sea fish that thrashed their tails in the fish market. Years later, the young woman would reveal this vision to an 18-year-old Julian Carax, recalling how the day she left the pension in the Ribera Quarter and moved to the Aldaya mansion, she was told that her friend Ramoneta had been stabbed to death in the doorway the night before, and that Ramoneta's baby had died of cold in her arms. When they heard the news, the guests of the pension came to blows, shouting and scratching over the meagre belongings of the dead woman. The only thing they left was what had been Ramoneta's greatest treasure, a book. Jacinta recognized it, because often at night Ramoneta had asked her to read her one or two pages, for Ramoneta had never learned to read. 4 months after Jorge Aldaya was born, and although Jacinta was to offer him all the affection that his mother never knew how to give him, or never wished to, for she was an ethereal lady, Jacinta thought, who always seemed trapped in her own reflection, the governess realized that this was not the child Zacarias had promised her. During those years, Jacinta gave up her youth and became a different woman. The other Jacinta had been left behind in the pension in the Ribera Quarter, as dead as Ramoneta. Now she lived in the shadow of the Aldaya's luxuries, far from that dark city that she had come to hate so much, and into which she did not venture, not even on her monthly day off. She learned to live through others, through a family that sat on top of a fortune the size of which she could scarcely conceive. She lived in the expectation of that child, who would be a female, like the city, and to whom she would give all the love with which God had poisoned her soul. Sometimes Jacinta asked herself whether that dreamy peace that filled her days, that absence of consciousness, was what some people called happiness. And she wanted to believe that God, in his infinite silence, had, in his way, answered her prayers. Penelope Aldaya was born in the spring of 1902. By then, Don Ricardo Aldaya had already bought the house on Avenida del Tibidabo, that rambling mansion that Jacinta's fellow servants were convinced lay under the influence of some powerful spell, but which Jacinta did not fear, because she knew that what others took to be magic was nothing more than a presence that only she could capture in dreams, the shadow of Zacarias, who hardly resembled the man she remembered and who now only manifested himself as a wolf walking on his two hind legs. Penelope was a fragile child, pale and slender. Jacinta saw her grow like a flower in winter. For years she watched over her every night, personally prepared every one of her meals, sewed her clothes, was by her side when she went through her many illnesses, when she said her first words, when she became a woman. Signora Aldaya was one more figure in the scenery, a prop that came on and off stage according to the dictates of decorum. Before going to bed, she would come and say good night to her daughter and tell her she loved her more than anything in the world, that she was the most important thing in the universe to her. Jacinta never told Penelope that she loved her,
The nurse knew that those who really love, love in silence, with deeds and not with words. Secretly, Jacinta despised Signora Aldaya, that vain, empty creature who slowly grew old in the corridors of the mansion, weighed down by the jewels with which her husband, who for years had set anchor in foreign ports, kept her quiet. She hated her because, of all women, God had chosen her to give birth to Penelope, while her own womb, the womb of the true mother, remained barren. In time, as if the words of her husband had been prophetic, Jacinta even lost her womanly shape. She grew thin and austere in appearance, and wore the look of tired skin and tired bone. Her breasts withered until they were but scraps of skin. Her hips were like those of a boy, and her flesh, hard and angular, didn't even catch the eye of Don Ricardo Aldaya, who only needed to sense a hint of vitality to send him off in a frenzy. As all the maids in the house, and in the houses of his close friends, knew only too well.
Better this way, thought Jacinta.
She had no time for nonsense. All her time was devoted to Penelope. She read to her. She accompanied her everywhere. She bathed her, dressed her, undressed her, combed her hair, took her out for walks, put her to bed and woke her up. But above all, she spoke to her. Everyone took Jacinta for a batty nurse, a spinster with nothing in her life other than her job in the house. But nobody knew the truth. Jacinta was not only Penelope's mother, she was her best friend. From the moment the girl began to speak and articulate her thoughts, which was much sooner than Jacinta remembered in any other child, they both shared their secrets and their lives. The passing of time only strengthened this union. When Penelope reached adolescence, they were already inseparable. Jacinta saw Penelope blossom into a woman whose beauty and radiance were evident to more eyes than just her own. When that mysterious boy called Julian came to the house, Jacinta noticed that, from the very first moment, a current flowed between him and Penelope. They were joined by a bond, similar to the one that joined her to Penelope, but also different, more intense, dangerous. At first she thought she would come to hate the boy, but soon she realized that she did not hate Julian Carax, and would never be able to. As Penelope fell under Julian's spell, she too allowed herself to be dragged into it, and in time desired only what Penelope desired. Nobody had noticed. Nobody had paid attention. But as usual, the essential issue had been settled before the story had even begun, and by then, it was too late. Many months of wistful looks and longings would pass before Julian Carax and Penelope could be alone together. Their lives were ruled by chance. They met in corridors. They looked at one another from opposite ends of the table. They brushed silently against each other. They felt each other's absence. They exchanged their first words in the library of the house on Avenida del Tibidabo, one stormy afternoon when Villa Penelope was filled with the dim light of candles. Only a few seconds stolen from the darkness in which Julian thought he saw in the girl's eyes the certainty that they both felt the same, that the same secret was devouring them. Nobody seemed to notice. Nobody but Jacinta, who watched with growing anxiety the game of furtive glances that Penelope and Julian were playing under the very nose of the Aldayas. She feared for them. By then, Julian had begun to have sleepless nights, writing stories for Penelope from midnight to dawn. He would find any old excuse to go up to the house on Avenida del Tibidabo, then look for the moment when he could slip into Jacinta's room and give his pages to her, so that she in turn could give them to the girl. Sometimes Jacinta would hand him a note that Penelope had written, and he would spend days rereading it. That game went on for months. While time brought them no good fortune, Julian did whatever was necessary to be close to Penelope. Jacinta helped him, for she wanted to see Penelope happy, to keep that light glowing. Julian, for his part, felt that the casual innocence of the beginning was now fading, and it was time to start making some sacrifices. That was why he began to lie to Don Ricardo about his plans for the future, to fake an enthusiasm for a career in banking and finance, to feign an affection and an attachment for Jorge Aldaya that he did not feel, in order to justify his almost constant presence in the house on Avenida del Tibidabo, to say only what he knew others wanted him to say, to read their looks and their hopes, to put aside honesty and sincerity, and to feel that he was selling his very soul. He began to fear that if he ever did come to deserve Penelope, there would be nothing left of the Julián who saw her the first time. Sometimes Julián would wake up at dawn, burning with anger, longing to tell the world his real feelings, to face Don Ricardo Aldaya and tell him he had no interest whatsoever in his fortune, his opportunities for the future, or his company, that all he wanted was his daughter, Penelope, and was thinking of taking her as far away as possible from that empty, shrouded world in which her father had imprisoned her. The light of day dispelled his courage. There were times when Julián opened his heart to Jacinta, who was beginning to love the boy more than she might have wished. She would often leave Penelope for a moment and, under the pretext of going to collect Jorge from school, would see Julián and deliver Penelope's messages to him. That was how she met Fernando, who, many years later, would be her only remaining friend while she awaited death in the hell of Santa Lucia, the hell that had been prophesied by the angel Zacharias. Sometimes the nurse would mischievously take Penelope with her to the school and facilitate a brief encounter between the two youngsters, watching a love grow between them such as she had never known, which had always been denied her. It was also around this time that Jacinta noticed the somber and disturbing presence of that quiet boy whom everyone called Francisco Javier, the son of the school's caretaker. She would catch him spying on them, reading their gestures from afar and devouring Penelope with his eyes. Jacinta kept a photograph of Julián and Penelope taken by Requesens, the Aldaya's official portrait photographer, by the door of the hat shop in the Ronda de San Antonio. It was an innocent image, taken at midday in the presence of Don Ricardo and of Sophie Carax. Jacinta always carried it with her. One day, while she was waiting for Jorge outside San Gabriel's, the governess absent-mindedly left her bag by one of the fountains and, when she went back for it, found young Fumero prowling around the area, looking at her nervously. That night she looked for the photograph but couldn't find it and was certain that the boy had stolen it. On another occasion, a few weeks later, Francisco Javier Fumero went up to Jacinta and asked her whether she could give Penelope something from him. When Jacinta asked what this thing was, the boy pulled out a piece of cloth in which he had wrapped what looked like a figure carved in pine wood. Jacinta recognized it was a carving of Penelope and felt a shiver. Before she was able to say anything, the boy left. On her way back to the house on Avenida del Tibidabo, Jacinta threw the figure out of the car window as if it were a piece of stinking carrion. More than once, Jacinta was to wake up at dawn, covered in sweat, plagued by nightmares in which that troubled-looking boy threw herself on Penelope with the cold and indifferent brutality of some strange insect. Some afternoons, when Jacinta went to fetch Jorge, and he was late, the governess would talk to Julián. He, too, was beginning to love that severe-looking woman. Whenever a problem cast a shadow over his life, she and Miquel Moliner were soon the first to know. Once Julián told Jacinta he had seen his mother and Don Ricardo Aldaya talking in the fountain courtyard while they waited for the pupils to come out. Don Ricardo seemed to be enjoying Sophie's company, and Julián felt a little uneasy because he was aware of the magnate's reputation as a Don Juan and of his voracious appetite for the delights of the female sex.
"I was telling your mother how much you like your new school," Don Ricardo told him when he said goodbye to them.
Don Ricardo gave them a wink and walked off, laughing boisterously. His mother was quiet during the journey home, clearly offended by the comments Don Ricardo Aldaya had made to her. Sophie was suspicious of Julian's growing bond with the Aldayas and the way he had abandoned his old neighbourhood friends and his family. She was not alone, but whereas his mother showed her displeasure in sadness and silence, the Hatter displayed only bitterness and spite. His initial enthusiasm about the widening of his clientele to include the flower of Barcelona society had evaporated. He hardly ever saw his son now, and soon had to employ Quimet, a local boy and one of Julian's former friends, as a helper and apprentice in the shop. And Tony Fortuny was a man who felt he could only talk openly about hats. He locked his deeper feelings in the prison of his heart for months on end, until they became hopelessly embittered. Every day he grew more bad-tempered and irritable. He found fault with everything, from the efforts of poor Quimet to learn the trade to Sophie's attempts to make light of Julian's seeming abandonment of them. "Your son thinks he's someone just because those rich folk treat him like a performing monkey," he said in a depressed tone full of resentment. One day, almost 3 years to the day since Don Ricardo Aldaya's first visit to the Fortunian son's hat shop, the Hatter left Quimet in charge of the shop and told him he'd be back at noon. He boldly presented himself at the offices of Aldaya's consortium on Paseo de Gracia and asked to see Don Ricardo. "And whom do I have the honour of announcing?" asked a clerk in a haughty manner. "His personal Hatter." Don Ricardo received him, somewhat surprised but well disposed, imagining that perhaps Fortuny was bringing him a bill. Small shopkeepers never quite understood the protocol when it came to money.
"So, tell me, what can I do for you, Fortunato, old fellow?"
Without further delay, Antoni Fortuny proceeded to explain to Don Ricardo that he was very much mistaken about his son, Julian.
"My son, Don Ricardo, is not the person you think he is. Quite the contrary. He is an arrogant, lazy boy with no more talent than the pretentious ideas his mother has put into his head. He'll never get anywhere, believe me. He lacks ambition and character. You don't know him. He can be very clever at sweet-talking strangers, making them believe he knows a lot about everything, when in fact he knows nothing about anything. He's a mediocre person. I know him better than anyone. And I thought I should warn you."
Don Ricardo Aldaya listened to the speech in silence without blinking.
"Is that all, Fortunato?"
Seeing that it was, the industrialist pressed a button on his desk. A few moments later, the secretary who had received Fortuny on arrival appeared at the office door.
"Our friend Fortunato is leaving, Balcells," Don Ricardo announced. "Please accompany him to the door."
The icy tone of the industrialist did not please the Hatter.
"If you don't mind, Don Ricardo, it's Fortuny, not Fortunato."
"Whatever. You're a very sad man, Fortuny. I'd appreciate it if you didn't come here again."
When Fortuny found himself back on the street, he felt more alone than ever, more convinced that everyone was against him. Only a few days later, the smart clients, brought in by his relationship with Aldaya, began to send messages cancelling their orders and settling their bills. In just a few weeks, he had to dismiss Quimet because there wasn't enough work for both of them. The boy wasn't much use anyhow, he told himself. He was mediocre and lazy, like all of them. It was around this time that people in the neighbourhood began to comment that Signor Fortuny was looking much older, lonelier, more bitter. He barely spoke to anyone anymore and spent hours on end shut up in the shop with nothing to do, watching people go by from behind his counter, feelings of disdain mingling with hope. Later people said that fashions changed, that young people no longer wore hats, that those who did would rather go to other shops where hats were sold ready-made in different sizes, with more modern designs and at a cheaper price. The Fortuny and Sons hat shop slowly sunk into a sad, silent slumber.
You're all waiting for me to die, Fortuny said to himself. Well, I might just give you that pleasure. In fact, he had started to die a long time ago.
Julian threw himself even more into the world of the Aldayas, into the only future he could conceive of, a future with Penelope. Almost 2 years went by in which the two of them walked on a tightrope of secrecy together. In his own way, Zacharias had given a warning long ago. Shadows spread around Julian, and soon they would close in on him. The first sign came one day in April 1918. Jorge Aldaya was going to be 18, and Don Ricardo, playing the role of great patriarch, had decided to organise, or rather, to give orders for someone to organise, a monumental birthday party that his son did not want, and from which he, Don Ricardo, would be absent, under the guise of important business commitments. He would be meeting a delicious lady, newly arrived from St. Petersburg, in the blue suite of the Hotel Colón. The house on Avenida del Tibidabo was turned into a circus for the occasion. Hundreds of lanterns, pennants, and stalls were set up in the gardens to delight the guests. Almost all of Jorge Aldaya's school companions from San Gabriel's had been invited. At Julian's suggestion, Jorge had included Francisco Javier Fumero. Miquel Moliner warned them that the son of the school caretaker would feel out of place in such pompous surroundings. Francisco Javier received his invitation, but, anticipating exactly the same thing, decided to turn it down. When Doña Yvonne, his mother, learned that her son was going to decline an invitation to the Aldaya's luxurious mansion, she was on the point of skinning him alive. What could that invitation be but a sign that she herself would soon be accepted into high society? The next step could only be an invitation to afternoon tea with Señora Aldaya and other ladies of unquestionable distinction. Doña Yvonne took the savings she had been scraping together out of her husband's pay and went out to buy a pretty sailor suit for her son. Francisco Javier was already 17 at the time, and that blue suit with short trousers, tailored to appeal to the none-too-refined sensibility of Doña Yvonne, looked grotesque and humiliating on the boy. Pressed by his mother, Francisco Javier accepted the invitation and spent a week carving a letter opener, which he intended to give Jorge as a present. On the day of the party, Doña Yvonne insisted on accompanying her son to the door of the Aldaya's house. She wanted to scent royalty and bask in the glory of seeing her son enter the doors that would soon open for her. When the moment came to put on his awful sailor suit, Francisco Javier discovered it was too small for him. Yvonne decided to adjust it somehow. They arrived late, in the meantime taking advantage of the hubbub and of Don Ricardo's absence, who no doubt was at that very moment celebrating in his own way. Julian had slipped away from the party. He and Penelope had arranged to meet in the library, where they didn't risk running into any of the other partygoers. They were too busy devouring each other's lips to notice the couple approaching the front door of the house. Francisco Javier, dressed in his First Communion sailor suit and purple with shame, was almost being dragged by Doña Yvonne, who for the occasion had decided to resurrect a broad-brimmed hat and a matching dress adorned with flourishes and bows. They made her look like a sweet stall, or in the words of Miquel Moliner, who sighted her from afar, a bison dressed up as Madame Recamier. The two servants guarding the door didn't seem very impressed by the visitors. Doña Yvonne announced that her son, Don Francisco Javier Fumera de Sotocheballos, was making his entrance. The two servants answered in a sarcastic tone that the name did not ring a bell. Irritated, but keeping the composure of a woman of substance, Yvonne told her son to show them the invitation. Unfortunately, when the suit was being fixed, the card had been left on Doña Yvonne's sewing table. Francisco Javier tried to explain the circumstances, but he stammered, and the laughter of the two servants did not help clear up the misunderstanding. Mother and son were invited to get the hell out of there. Doña Yvonne was inflamed with anger and announced that the servants didn't know who they were dealing with. The servants replied that the floor cleaner's position was already taken. From her bedroom window, Jacinta watched Francisco Javier turn to leave, then suddenly stop. Beyond the scene his mother was creating, shouting herself hoarse at the arrogant servants. The boy saw them, Julian kissing Penelope by the large window of the library. They were kissing with the intensity of those who belong to one another, unaware of the world around them. The following day, during the midday break, Francisco Javier appeared unexpectedly. News of the previous day's scene had already spread among the pupils. He was met with laughter and questioned about what he'd done with his little sailor suit. The laughter ended abruptly when the boys noticed he was carrying his father's gun. There was complete silence, and many of them moved away. Only the circle formed by Aldaya, Moliner, Fernando, and Julian turned around and stared at the boy without understanding. Francisco Javier gave no warning. He raised his rifle and aimed. Later, witnesses said there was no irritation or anger in his expression. Francisco Javier displayed the same automatic coolness with which he performed his cleaning jobs in the garden. The first bullet scraped past Julian's head. The second would have gone through his throat, had Miquel Moliner not thrown himself on the caretaker's son, punched him, and wrenched the gun from him. Julian Carax watched the scene in astonishment, paralysed. Everyone thought the shots were aimed at Jorge Aldaya in revenge for the humiliation Javier had suffered the day before. Only later, when the civil guards were taking the boy away and the caretakers were being almost literally kicked out of their home, did Miquel Moliner go up to Julian and tell him, without any pride, that he had saved his life. It was the last year for Julian and his companions at San Gabriel's school. Most of them were already talking about their plans, or about the plans their respective families had set up for them, for the following year. Jorge Aldaya already knew that his father was sending him to study in England, and Miquel Moliner took it for granted that he would go to Barcelona University. Fernando Ramos had mentioned more than once that perhaps he would enter the seminary of the Society of Jesus, a prospect his teachers considered the wisest in his particular situation. As for Francisco Javier Fumero, all anyone knew about the boy was that, thanks to Don Ricardo Aldaya, who interceded on his behalf, he had been taken to a reformatory school high in a remote valley of the Pyrenees, where a long winter awaited him. Seeing that all his friends had found some direction in life, Julian wondered what would become of himself. His literary dreams and ambitions seemed further away and more unfeasible than ever. All he longed for was to be near Penelope. While he pondered his future, others were planning it for him. Don Ricardo Aldaya was already preparing a post for him in his firm to initiate him into the business. The hatter, for his part, had decided that if his son did not want to continue in the family business, he could forget about sponging off him. He had secretly set in motion his plan to send Julian to the army, where a few years of military life would cure him of his delusions of grandeur. Julian was unaware of such plans, and by the time he found out what others had arranged for him, it would be too late. Only Penelope occupied his thoughts. And now the feigned distance and the clandestine meetings no longer satisfied him. He insisted on seeing her more often, increasing the risk of discovery. Jacinta did what she could to cover for them. She lied repeatedly and concocted 1,001 ruses to give them a few moments on their own. She understood that this was not enough for Penelope and Julian. The governess had for some time now recognized in their looks the defiance and arrogance of desire, a blind desire to be discovered, a hope that their secret would become an open scandal so that they would no longer have to hide in corners and attics, to love one another in the dark. Sometimes when Jacinta tucked Penelope up at night, the girl would burst into floods of tears and confess how she longed to flee with Julian, to catch the first train and escape to a place where nobody would know them. Jacinta, who remembered the sort of world that existed beyond the iron gates of the Aldaya mansion, shuddered and tried to dissuade her. Penelope was docile by nature, and the fear she saw in Jacinta's face was enough to soothe her. Julian was another matter. During that last spring at San Gabriel's, Julian was unnerved to discover that Don Ricardo Aldaya and his mother sometimes met secretly. At first he feared that the industrialist might have decided to add the conquest of Sophie to his collection, but soon he realised that the meetings, which always took place in cafes in the centre of town and were carried out with the utmost propriety, were limited to conversation. Sophie kept silent about these meetings. When at last Julian decided to ask Don Ricardo what was going on between him and his mother, the magnate laughed.
"Nothing gets by you, does it, Julian? The fact is, I was going to talk to you about this matter. Your mother and I are discussing your future. She came to see me a few weeks ago. She was worried because your father wants to send you away to the army next year. Your mother, quite naturally, wants the best for you. And she came to me to see whether between the two of us we could do anything. Don't worry. You have Don Ricardo Aldaya's word that you won't become cannon fodder. Your mother and I have great plans for you. Trust us."
Julian wanted to trust him, yet Don Ricardo inspired anything but trust. When he consulted Miquel Moliner, the boy agreed with Julian. "If what you want to do is elope with Penelope, and may God help you, what you need is money." Money was exactly what Julian didn't have. "That can be arranged," Miquel told him. "That's what rich friends are for." That is how Miquel and Julian began to plan the lovers' escape. The destination, at Miquel's suggestion, would be Paris. Moliner was of the opinion that if Julian was set on being a starving bohemian artist, at least a Parisian setting couldn't be improved upon. Penelope spoke a little French, and for Julian, who had learned it from his mother, it was his second language. Besides, Paris is large enough to get lost in, but small enough to offer opportunities, Miquel reasoned. Miquel managed to put together a small fortune, joining his savings from many years to what he was able to extort from his father using the most outlandish excuses. Only he knew where the money was really going. "And I plan to go dumb the minute you two board that train." That same afternoon, after finalising details with Moliner, Julian went to the house on Avenida del Tibidabo to tell Penelope about the plan.
"You mustn't tell anyone what I'm about to tell you. No one, not even Jacinta," Julian began.
The girl listened to him in astonishment, enthralled. Moliner's plan was impeccable. Miquel would buy the tickets under a false name and hire a third party to collect them at the ticket office in the station. If by any chance the police discovered him, all he'd be able to give them would be the description of someone who did not look like Julian. Julian and Penelope would meet on the train. There would be no waiting on the platform where they might be seen. The escape would take place on a Sunday at midday. Julian would make his own way to the Estación de Francia. Miquel would be there waiting for him with the tickets and the money. The most delicate part of the plan concerned Penelope. She had to deceive Jacinta and ask her to invent an excuse for taking her out of the 11 o'clock mass and returning home. On the way, Penelope would ask Jacinta to let her go and meet Julian, promising to be back before the family had returned to the mansion. This would be Penelope's opportunity to get to the station. They both knew that, if they told her the truth, Jacinta would not allow them to leave. She loved them too much.
"It's the perfect plan, Miquel," Julian said.
Miquel nodded sadly. "Except for one detail. The pain you are going to cause a lot of people by going away. Forever." Julian nodded, thinking of his mother and Jacinta. It did not occur to him that Miquel Moliner was talking about himself. The most difficult thing was convincing Penelope of the need to keep Jacinta in the dark. Only Mikkel would know the truth. The train left at 1 in the afternoon. By the time Penelope's absence was noticed, the couple would have crossed the border. Once in Paris, they would settle in a hostel as man and wife using a false name. They would then send Mikkel Moliner a letter addressed to their families, confessing their love, telling them they were well, that they loved them, announcing their church wedding, and asking for forgiveness and understanding. Mikkel Moliner would put the letter in a second envelope to do away with the Paris postmark, and he would see to it that it was posted from some nearby town.
"When?"
asked Penelope. "In 6 days' time," said Julian. "This coming Sunday." Mikkel reckoned it would be best if Julian didn't see Penelope during the days left prior to the elopement, so as not to arouse suspicion. They should both agree not to see each other again until they met on the train on their way to Paris. 6 days without seeing her, without touching her, seemed interminable to Julian. They sealed the pact, the secret marriage, with a kiss. It was then that Julian took Penelope to Jacinta's bedroom on the third floor of the house. Only the servants' quarters were on that floor, and Julian was sure nobody would discover them. They undressed feverishly, with an angry passion and desire, scratching each other's skin and melting into silence. They learned each other's bodies by heart and buried all thoughts of those 6 days of separation. Julian penetrated Penelope with fury, pressing her against the floorboards. She received him with open eyes, her legs hugging his torso, her lips half open with yearning. There was not a glimmer of fragility or childishness in her eyes or in her warm body. Later, with his face still resting on her stomach and his hands on her white, tremulous breasts, Julian knew he had to say goodbye. He had barely had time to sit up when the door of the room slowly opened and a woman's shape appeared at the doorway. For a second, Julian thought it was Jacinta. But he soon realized it was Signora Aldaya. She was watching them, spellbound, with a mixture of fascination and disgust. All she managed to mumble was,
"Where's Jacinta?"
Then she just turned and walked away without saying a word, while Penelope crouched on the floor in mute agony, and Julian felt the world collapsing around him.
"Go now, Julian. Go before my father comes. But go!"
Julian nodded.
"Whatever happens, I'll wait for you on Sunday, on that train."
Penelope managed a faint smile.
"I'll be there. Now go, please."
She was still naked when he left her and slid down the servant's staircase towards the coach houses and out into the coldest night he could remember. The days that followed were agony. Julian had spent all night awake expecting that Don Ricardo's hired assassins would come for him at any moment. The following day in school, he didn't notice any change of attitude in Jorge Aldaya. Devoured by anguish, Julian told Mikkel Moliner what had happened. Mikkel shook his head. "You're crazy, Julian, but that's nothing new. What's strange is that there hasn't been an upheaval in the Aldaya's house, which, come to think of it, isn't so surprising. If, as you say, it was Signora Aldaya who discovered you, it might be that she still doesn't know what to do. I've had 3 conversations with her in my life and came to 2 conclusions. 1, Signora Aldaya has the mental age of a 12-year-old. 2, she suffers from a chronic narcissism that makes it impossible for her to see or understand anything that is not what she wants to see or believe, especially if it concerns herself." "Spare me the diagnosis, Mikkel. What I mean is that she's probably still wondering what to say, how to say it, when, and to whom. First, she must think of the consequences for herself, the potential scandal, her husband's fury. The rest, I dare say, she couldn't care less about."
"So you think she won't say anything?"
"She might take a day or two, but I don't think she's capable of keeping such a secret from her husband. What about the escape plan? Is it still on?"
"More than ever."
"I'm glad to hear that, because I really believe that now there's no turning back." The week stretched out interminably. Julian went to school every day with uncertainty hard on his heels. He passed the time merely pretending to be there, barely able to exchange glances with Michael Molinaire, who was beginning to be just as worried about him, or more so. Jorge Aldaya said nothing. He was as polite as ever. Jacinta had not turned up again to collect Jorge from school. Don Ricardo's chauffeur came every afternoon. Julian felt like dying, wishing that whatever was going to happen would happen, so that the waiting would come to an end. On Thursday afternoon after class, Julian began to think that luck was on his side. Signora Aldaya had not said anything, perhaps out of shame, stupidity, or for any of the reasons Michael had suggested. It mattered little. All that mattered was that she kept the secret until Sunday. That night, for the first time in a number of days, Julian was able to sleep. On Friday morning, when he went to class, Father Ramanones was waiting for him by the gate.
Julian, I have to speak to you.
What is it, Father?
I always knew this day would come, and I must confess I'm happy to be the one who will break the news to you.
What news, Father? Julian Carax was no longer a pupil at San Gabriel School. His presence in the compound, the classrooms, and even the gardens was strictly forbidden. His school items, textbooks, and all other belongings were now school property.
The technical term is immediate and total expulsion, Father Ramanones summed up.
May I ask the reason?
I can think of a dozen, but I'm sure you'll know how to choose the most appropriate one. Good day, Carax. And good luck in your life. You're going to need it.
Some 30 yards away, in the fountain's courtyard, a group of pupils was watching him. Some were laughing, waving goodbye. Others looked at him with pity and bewilderment. Only one smiled sadly. His friend, Michael Molinaire, who simply nodded and silently mouthed some words that Julian thought he could read in the air.
See you on Sunday.
When he got back to the apartment in Ronda de San Antonio, Julian noticed Don Ricardo's Mercedes-Benz parked outside the hat shop. He stopped on the corner and waited. After a while, Don Ricardo came out of his father's shop and got into the car. Julian hid in a doorway until the car set off towards Plaza Universidad. Only then did he rush up the stairs to his home. His mother, Sophie, was waiting there, in floods of tears.
What have you done, Julian?
She murmured without anger.
Forgive me, mother.
Sophie held her son close. She had lost weight and had aged, as if between them all they had stolen her life and her youth. I more so than anyone, thought Julian.
Listen to me carefully, Julian. Your father and Don Ricardo Aldaya have got everything set up to send you to the army in a few days' time. Aldaya has a great deal of influence. You have to go, Julian. You have to go where neither of them can find you.
Julian thought he saw a shadow in his mother's eyes that seemed to take hold of her.
Is there anything else, Mother? Something you haven't told me?
Sophie gazed at him with trembling lips.
You must go. We must both go away from here forever.
Julian held her tight and whispered in her ear.
Don't worry about me, Mother. Don't you worry.
Julian spent the Saturday shut up in his room, among his books and his drawing pads. The hatter had gone down to the shop just after dawn and didn't return until the early hours. He doesn't have the courage to tell me to my face, thought Julian. That night, his eyes blurred with tears, Julian said farewell to the years he had spent in that dark, cold room, lost amid dreams, that he now knew would never come true. Sunday, at daybreak, armed with only a bag containing a few clothes and books, he kissed Sophie's forehead as she lay curled under blankets in the dining room, and left. The street seemed enveloped in a blue haze. Flashes of copper sparkled on the flat roofs of the old town. He walked slowly, saying goodbye to every door, to every street corner, wondering whether the illusions of time would turn out to be true and that, in days to come, he would be able to remember only the good things and forget the solitude that had so often hounded him in those streets. The Estación de Francia was deserted. The platforms, reflecting the burning light of dawn, curved off into the mist like glistening sabres. Julian sat on a bench under the vaulted ceiling and took out his book. He let the hours go by, lost in the magic of words, shedding his skin and his name, feeling like another person. He allowed himself to be carried away by the dreams of shadowy characters, the only refuge left for him. By then he knew that Penelope wouldn't come. He knew he would board that train with no other company than his memories. When, just before noon, Michael Molinaire arrived in the station and gave him the tickets and all the money he had been able to gather, the two friends embraced without a word. Julian had never seen Michael Molinaire cry. Clocks were everywhere, counting the minutes as they flew by. "There's still time," Michael murmured, his eyes fixed on the station entrance. At 1:05, the station master gave the last call for passengers travelling to Paris. The train had already started to slide along the platform when Julian turned round to say goodbye to his friend. Michael Molinaire stood there watching him, his hands buried in his pockets.
"Right," he said.
"I'll write to you as soon as I get there," answered Julian.
"No, not to me. Write books, not letters. Write them for me, for Penelope."
Julian nodded, realising only then how much he was going to miss his friend.
"And keep your dreams," said Michael. "You never know when you might need them."
"Always," murmured Julian. But the roar of the train had already stolen his words.
"The night her mother caught them in my bedroom, Penelope told me what had happened. The following day, Signora Aldaya called for me and asked me what I knew about Julian. I said I didn't know anything except that he was a nice boy, a friend of Jorge's. She ordered me to keep Penelope locked in her room until she was given permission to come out. Don Ricardo was away in Madrid and didn't come back until early on Friday. As soon as he arrived, Signora Aldaya told him what she'd witnessed. I was there. Don Ricardo jumped up from his armchair and slapped his wife so hard she fell on the floor. Then, shouting like a madman, he told her to repeat what she had just said. Signora Aldaya was terrified. We had never seen her husband like that, never. He looked as if he were possessed by all the devils in hell. Seething with anger, he went up to Penelope's bedroom and pulled her out of her bed, dragging her by the hair. I tried to stop him, but he kicked me aside. That same evening, he called the family doctor and had him examine Penelope. When the doctor had finished, he spoke to Signor Aldaya. They locked Penelope up in her room, and Signora Aldaya told me to collect my things. They didn't let me see Penelope. I never said goodbye to her. Don Ricardo threatened to report me to the police if I told anyone what had happened. That very night they threw me out, with nowhere to go, after 18 years of uninterrupted service in the house. 2 days later, in a pension in Calle Muntaner, I had a visit from Michael Molinaire, who told me that Julian had gone to Paris. He wanted me to tell him why Penelope hadn't come to the station as arranged. For weeks, I returned to the house, begging for a chance to see her, but I wasn't even allowed to cross the gates. I would position myself on the opposite corner every day,
for days on end, hoping to see them come out. I never saw her. She didn't come out of the house. Later on, Signor Aldaya called the police, and with the help of his high-powered friends, managed to get me committed to the lunatic asylum in Horta, claiming that nobody knew me, that I was some demented woman who harassed his family and children. I spent 2 years there, locked up like an animal. The first thing I did when I got out was to go to the house on Avenida del Tibidabo to see Penelope.
Did you manage to see her?
Fermin asked. The house was locked and up for sale. Nobody lived there. I was told that the Aldayas had gone to Argentina. I wrote to the address I was given. The letters were returned to me unopened.
What happened to Penelope? Do you know?
Jacinta shook her head, in a state of near collapse.
I never saw her again.
The old woman moaned and began to weep uncontrollably. Fermin held her in his arms and rocked her. Jacinta Coronado had shrunk to the size of a little girl, and next to her Fermin looked like a giant. I had questions burning in my head, but my friend signalled to me that the interview was over. I saw him gazing about him in that dirty, cold hovel where Jacinta Coronado was spending her last days. Come on, Daniel. We're leaving. You go first. I did what I was told. As I walked away, I turned for a moment and saw Fermin kneel down by the old lady and kiss her on the forehead. She gave him a toothless smile. Tell me, Jacinta, I heard Fermin saying. You like sugus sweets, don't you? On our circuitous path back to the exit, we passed the real undertaker and his two cadaverous assistants, carrying a cheap pine coffin, rope, and what looked suspiciously like a recycled shroud. The committee gave off a sinister smell of formaldehyde and cheap eau de cologne. The men's bloodless skin framed gaunt canine smiles. Fermin pointed to the cell where the body of the deceased awaited, and proceeded to bless the trio, who nodded respectfully and made the sign of the cross. Go in peace, mumbled Fermin, dragging me towards the exit, where a nun holding an oil lamp saw us off with a harsh, condemnatory look. Once we were out of the building, the grim canyon of stone and shadow that was Calle Moncada seemed more like an inviting valley of hope. Fermin breathed deeply with relief, and I knew I wasn't the only one to be rejoicing at having left that place behind. Jacinta's story weighed on our consciences more than we would have wished to admit.
Listen, Daniel, what would you say to some ham croquettes and a couple of glasses of sparkling wine here in the Zampagnette, just to take away the bad taste in our mouths?
I wouldn't say no, quite frankly.
Didn't you arrange to meet up with the girl today?
Tomorrow.
Ah, you devil. You're playing hard to get, eh? You're learning fast.
We had taken 10 steps towards the noisy tavern, just a few doors down the street, when 3 silhouettes materialised out of the shadows and intercepted us. 2 positioned themselves behind us, so close I could feel their breath on the nape of my neck. The third, smaller, but much more menacing, blocked our way. It was him. He wore the usual raincoat, and his oily smile oozed irrepressible glee.
Why? Who have we here, if it's not my old friend, the man of the 1,000 faces, cried Inspector Fumero.
It seemed to me I could hear all of Fermin's bones shudder with terror at the apparition. My loquacious friend could manage only a stifled groan. The 2 thugs, who I guessed were 2 agents from the crime squad, grabbed us by the scruffs of our necks and held our right wrists, ready to twist our arms at the slightest hint of movement.
I see from your look of surprise that you thought I'd lost track of you long ago. Surely you didn't think a piece of shit like you was going to be able to crawl out of the gutter and pass himself off as a decent citizen. You might be stupid, but not that stupid. Besides, I'm told you're poking your nose, and it's quite a nose, in a whole pile of things that are none of your business. That's a bad sign. What is it with you and those little nuns? Are you having it off with one of them? How much do they charge these days? I respect other people's asses, Inspector, especially if they are cloistered. Perhaps if you were inclined to do the same, you would save yourself a hefty bill in penicillin and improve the number and ease of your bowel movements. Fumero let out a little laugh streaked with anger. Oh, that's right, balls of steel. If all crooks were like you, my work would be a party. And tell me, what are you calling yourself these days, you son of a bitch? Gary Cooper? Come on, tell me what you're up to, sticking that big nose of yours in the hospice of Santa Lucia, and I might let you go with just a warning. Come on, spell it out. What brings you two here? A private matter. We came to visit a relative. Sure, your fucking mother. Look here, you happen to have caught me on a good day, otherwise I'd be taking you to headquarters and giving you another session with a welding torch. Come on, be a good boy. And tell your old friend Inspector Fumero the truth about what the fuck you and your friend are doing here. Damn it, just cooperate a bit and you'll save me beating up this smart little kid you've chosen as a sponsor. You touch a single hair of his and I'll swear I'll... You scare me to bits, really. I just shat my pants. Fermin swallowed as if to hold in all the courage that was seeping out of him. Those wouldn't be the same sailor boy pants that your esteemed mother, the illustrious kitchen maid, made you wear. That would be a shame. I'm told the outfit really suited you.
Inspector Fumero's face paled, and all expression left his eyes.
What did you say, motherfucker? I was saying it looks like you've inherited all the taste and charm of Doña Yvonne Sotaceballos, a high society lady.
Fermin was not a heavy man, and the first punch was enough to knock him off his feet and into a puddle of water. He lay curled up in a ball as Fumero meted out a flurry of kicks to his stomach, kidneys and face. I lost count after the fifth. Fermin lost his breath and then, a moment later, the ability to protect himself from the blows. The two policemen who were holding me down with iron hands were laughing dutifully.
"Don't get involved," one of them whispered to me. "I don't feel like breaking your arm."
I tried in vain to wriggle out of his grip, and as I struggled, I caught a glimpse of him. I recognized his face immediately. He was the man in the raincoat with the newspaper, who was in the bar at Plaza de Sarriá a few days earlier, the same man who had followed us in the bus and laughed at Fermin's jokes.
Look, the one thing that really pisses me off is people who stir up shit from the past, Fumero cried out. The past must be left alone, do you understand? And that goes for you and your dumb friend. Look and learn, kid. You're next.
The whole time I watched Inspector Fumero destroy Fermin with his kicks, I was unable to utter a word. I remember the dull, terrible impact of the blows raining down mercilessly on my friend. They hurt me still. All I did was take refuge in the policeman's convenient grasp, trembling and shedding silent, cowardly tears. When Fumero tired of striking a dead weight, he opened up his raincoat, unzipped his fly, and began to urinate on Fermin. My friend didn't move. He looked like a bundle of old clothes in a puddle. While Fumero discharged his generous, steamy cascade over Fermin, I still couldn't speak. When he'd finished, the inspector zipped up his trousers and came over to me, sweaty-faced and panting. One of the police officers handed him a handkerchief and he mopped his face and neck. He came closer until his face was only a couple of inches from mine, and he fixed me with his stare.
You weren't worth that beating, kid. That's the problem with your friend. He always backs the wrong side. Next time I'm going to fuck him up like I've never done before. And I'm sure it's
going to be your fault. I thought he was going to hit me then, that my turn had come. For some reason I was glad. I wanted to believe that his blows would cure me of the shame I felt for not having raised a finger to help Fermin, when the only thing he'd been trying to do, as usual, was protect me. But no blow came. All Fumero did was pat me on the cheek. "It's okay, boy. I don't dirty my hands with cowards." The two policemen chuckled, more relaxed now that they knew the show was over. Their desire to leave the scene was obvious. They went off, laughing in the dark. By the time I went to his aid, Fermin was trying in vain to get up and find the teeth he'd lost in the dirty water of the puddle. His mouth, nose, ears and eyelids were all bleeding. When he saw that I was unharmed, he attempted to smile, and I thought he was going to die on the spot. I knelt beside him and held him in my arms. The first thought that crossed my mind was that he weighed less than Bea.
"Fermin, for God's sake, we must get you to a hospital right away."
He shook his head energetically.
"Take me to her."
"To who, Fermin?"
"To Bernarda. If I'm going to die, I'd rather it was in her arms."